Hi, I'm John Ingold.
I'm Sagar Bharati.
And welcome to the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope podcast. Each week, we open the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope book to a random article, and we invite the author of that article onto the show to talk to us about what they wrote, their ideas, and in general, their approach to the writing and craft of interactive narrative. This week, we're really excited to have Emma Kidwell with us. Hi, Emma, how are you doing?
Hi, John. I'm doing well. I'm glad to see the sun for the first time in several weeks, so I'm pumped to be here and talk about video games.
Fantastic. I should say we're recording this in May. It'll probably come out in October when the sun will have long since disappeared again.
So unfortunately.
Enjoy the memory while we can. So the first question that we normally ask is for the benefit of people who maybe don't know your name, but have probably know the games you've worked on. Can you just give us a sort of brief summary of who you are and how do you fit into the wide world of game narrative?
Yeah. So I got my start 10 years ago in games journalism, writing for what used to be known as Gamasutra.com. They are now known as Game Developer. So I actually went to game design college for 2 years in the city of Baltimore, Maryland. And I was learning foundational, tools to become a multifaceted designer, because we had different tracks. You had your level design, your programming. When I joined 10 years ago, they had a narrative track. And as soon as I transferred, they took it away, which I think is very funny considering the trajectory of narrative since then and how it's viewed in studios. But I was introduced to the concept of video games being more than just what you see behind me. You have like your consoles and your high fidelity AAAs, because that's what I grew up on. So I assumed that's the type of video game I'm going to write. And going into college, and I took an intro to narrative class, which covered all sorts of narrative writing for video games and also covering video games from a media, a journalistic standpoint. So I learned how to write a lot, and I was able to realize that video games are also art. And I'm not getting into that conversation, but you know, a 19-year-old thinking, I've played BioShock and Call of Duty and Mass Effect, so I know what video games are, and realizing there's this whole other avenue of games. But coming back to that, I was able to get a job right out of college covering events and covering news for Gamasutra, Game Developer. And in my spare time at night, I would make memoir games in Twine. And that's how I padded up my portfolio. And I had no business applying to some of the figureheads that exist now when I was in my early 20s. But that's what I had to show them. And it eventually got me my first gig contract at Hangar 13. So I did that, all while still making Twines. And as is with most places, the studio that the project that I was hired on was canceled. So I was a free agent, and it happened to be that because 2K is the parent company of Firaxis, and they were shipping Marvel's Midnight Suns, they said, hey, we'll take you and you can help us write the game. And that ended up being my job application, because a couple months later, they were like, we have a writer position open and we liked your work on Midnight Suns. Would you like to write some DLC? That's how I wrote for Deadpool and Storm. And I got laid off back in September of 25, but I worked on Civilization before that, Civilization 7, excuse me. And all while I was working in AAA, I was still making my own games or working on indie stuff at night, which is how I'm rambling so much, or I'm talking so much. It's not rambling. But
please keep going. This is interesting. Yeah.
My memoir work, my Twine work, led me to a developer named Joel McDonald. And he made oh my gosh, my name is blanking.
Hindsight,
yes. Before that, he made another beautiful game that was on mobile through the Apple Store, but Prune. And we were introduced through my memoir work, and that is how I was brought on to write Hindsight. And I did that while working my 9-to-5 and subsequently got very burnt out. So I took a leave of absence last year for a little bit and was able to play video games and remember what it feels like to be a person who has hobbies and doesn't just turn their day job into, or their hobby into their day job. All that to say, I did a lot of grinding, and I'm in a position now where I'm kind of like a free-floating agent again. I've freelanced, I've written on Borderlands 4, and I can't talk about the contributions that I've made, but I did work on the Aliens Fireteam Elite 2, which has been announced, and I think that's recently. All I can say about that. Yeah. So I've done a lot. It doesn't feel like it, but now that I'm trying to condense all the work that I've done in the span of 3 minutes, seems like a lot.
Yeah.
It's funny how that works, right?
Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. It's we've spoken to quite a lot of writers and narrative designers now, and you know, there's a large number of them who come from game journalism. There's a large number of them who come from Twine development. There's also this huge intersection of both.
Yeah.
Like people who have just done a little bit of everything in every kind of aspect of the industry, and we see more and more how many writers and narrative designers have these quite interesting sort of patchwork careers that, like, ultimately I think that is what a narrative design career looks like in 2026. Is like, oh, I seem to have done 25 projects. I thought I'd done two, but actually I've done, and like, so especially if you're counting the independent ones. But we can
especially
get into
the cancelled ones too.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, well, too. You know,
and we have to count. We have to count the dead. That is true.
Well, this gives us a good little hook. So you've hit and seen a pretty wide array of the industry, actually, it sounds like, Emma. And so it helps explain to me a little bit about how you've found the take that you've done for your article here. But let's talk about this a little bit, if you don't mind. So your article is called "Your AAA Game Should Be More Mundane." Tell us a bit about what you had in mind for that.
Yes. So a large portion of the article starts out with setting up the scene for a quest called The Dinner in, I think it was 2013's Beyond Two Souls by Quantic Dream. And the entire premise for that, and it was the first time in 2013, I was in my early 20s, so I was still figuring out what kind of narrative games I liked. And I figured the less gameplay there is, the more, I don't know if the term walking simulator, I feel like, has all but died, but that was the type of game that once I realized, oh, I want to write specifically video games, this is the type of stuff that I like. And why do I like it? Oh, I like going through people's stuff and looking at it. I want to know what kind of story a mess tells, I guess. Or I go to other people's homes and I start looking through your collection of books because I want to know this tells me about you. Yeah. And so I figured in a video game, that's storytelling as well. And as I've worked throughout different stages of game development and realizing, oh, nothing is for free. So the fact that this entire almost 40-minute quest is pretty much setting myself to get ready for a date, it still stuck up to me, 13 years later. And I was thinking, okay, why? Why is that sticking out to me? Why am I remembering that so vividly? And when I went and watched a playthrough, because I'm not going to boot up my very old copy of Beyond Two Souls, I realized that it's a mundanity or the concept of like doing boring tasks is such a underutilized vehicle for story or character development, because mess tells us things about people. And why wouldn't, you know, the way they handle getting ready for a date, or the way that they handle conflict. And of course, the supernatural element or the driver of, you know, getting ready for the date is that you need to get ready in X amount of time. And also this entity that is your brother is kind of haunting you. So you are you're a girl trying to get ready for a date, but you've got things going on. All that to say, it made me wonder why video games with the bigger budgets that we have and the really skilled people that are there? Why aren't we doing more? Or why is there no value in, I guess, being boring? Because clearly, if I'm not the only one remembering that is like stood out, why, I guess? And this was me trying to, my article was me trying to make the point that if you give your players a space to breathe and kind of role play a normal life through the character or the player fantasy that you've projected, then that can do so much more than like a typical action set piece. And I brought up Cyberpunk 2077 as having a quest line that stood out and is the only one that I remember like off the top of my head without having to replay it, which is Jackie's ofrenda from after he passes away. Because as far as I'm aware, I've never chosen not to go or to pay my respects because I can't roleplay a bitch. I just can't. I always will make the same decisions in an RPG. I appreciate that the option is there, but it stuck out to me because I'd never had like an action RPG or a shooter other than the very unfortunate press F to pay respect.
Yes, of course.
The classic. That was my only other, in a AAA game, my only other exposure to a game asking you to participate in a character's death and to see them off, and you as V get to choose what memento meant the most to your time with Jackie. And you don't have to do that. I could have just left. I could have just said, all right, see you, Jackie, and not participated in this. So I appreciated the quest designers and the writers who took Jackie's heritage too and incorporated that, because it's not a funeral. It's an ofrenda. It's a very different way to see off the dead. And like that, I don't know. The more that I've been in dev, the more I realize that these are storytelling opportunities that need to be in more of our AAA games. And also it sticks out for a reason, I think, because we want to seek that human connection. And I think video games that pause and ask us to reflect in the same way that we do in life is only a good thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I like this for a thousand reasons, right? But I think like maybe one of those reasons is your approach of curiosity to this. Like, why has this thing stuck with you? Because we all have that, right? Like, we all have a couple scenes that we're like, I played this like decades ago, and yet like it still goes over and over in my head, right? I'm sure all of us could sort of come up with something. And I think you've given some really good examples. But from the other perspective, in some ways, of course, it's not surprising that we get to do it, because it's like dense with emotion, right? Of course it is, right? Like these types of moments in particular are dense with a type of tension that we don't always get to experience in games, mm-hmm. right? It's almost like as a medium, we have issues with pacing. Like we've become weirdly comfortable with pacing that involves life and death, but weirdly uncomfortable with pacing that involves actual real life stakes, like the types of things that you might experience. And you know, we're of course worried about players getting bored, I suppose. Yeah, I don't know. You point out in the article and in what you've just given for us here verbally that there's an expense involved, and that's clearly so true. I mean, there was custom art that was done. There were custom animations in both of the examples that you came up with. Every single one of those things needed to have time allocated by some producer for some department. Absolutely true, right? But I guess it does imply to me that if there were like games with different and cheaper, let's say, art styles, we should expect to see such quiet moments more frequently. We certainly do in a game like Hindsight, I think. But what do you think? Is that something that you feel is true, that you've observed in games that are at different levels? Because you've been careful to make sure that, you know, your point here, you're focusing on AAA. But do we actually have a large number of different games that are testing this out in different ways, albeit maybe not at this level of graphical fidelity? What do you think?
Oh, yeah. I think memoir games are essentially, I don't want to say boring or mundane, but they're slice of life. They're games based on someone else's experience. And it's memoir being a term that was coined within the last decade. I want to give credit to Chris Plant, I believe, on Post Games. He's the one that I saw first mention it. He's a great podcast, Post Games. Yeah. Yes. The one that he did with Meredith Gran on Station to Station, Perfect Tides. I got that backwards, but...
Yeah. Perfect Tides, yeah.
Yeah, so he mentions, or he asks what memoir games are, or you know, provides an explanation. But like 10 years ago, memoir was known as just personal games, autobiographical games, or vignettes. And the game designer who wrote a Gamasutra article about it years ago, I can't remember his name, and it's going to come back to me later, but it's... indie games are pretty much have been doing that, I guess, depending on the genre of the game. I think of memoir first just because that's how I kind of realized, that's where I started writing stories or telling stories, was just based on my own life. And I was inspired by game designer Nina Freeman, who is well known for her memoir work, Sybil especially, and stuff like games like How Do You Do It, which is just How Do You Do It is two dolls. It's a little girl learning how to learning about sex by smashing two dolls together. And that's the game. And that's boring. Like, that's mundane, but when I get passionate about something, I'm sorry, I don't really know. It's hard for me to find the language or come back to it, but hindsight. Sorry. Can you ask me the question again? Because
I love this. I love this, actually. Yeah. So my question is, in some ways, perhaps this is obvious, right? But you've restricted your point to AAA games. And you've said that it's been about the expense. That's the reason we don't see these types of scenes more often. So it occurs to me that in games that are cheaper to produce in some way or other, if this is something that is burgeoning beneath us, that we should be able to see it more frequently. And I guess the implication I'm making is it a question of priority? Is it like you need someone who's like, no, clearly we need to have the ofrenda scene in here?
Oh,
or
yeah.
Is it a question of... Or is it a question of sort of capability, right? Well, we simply can't fit this in because that's just not in the budget for this type of project. Yeah,
I think it has to do with more to your former point. I think people also don't realize that for some reason, I don't think this is related at all, but I'm reminded of hub spaces becoming a little more common in. I think of Marvel's Midnight Suns just because I worked on it, and it's one of the things that I can talk about that have hub spaces, because you have, you know, your premise of you are going out, you are picking heroes to go out and complete a mission, and you go do that. You don't have a lot of moments for storytelling, and the gameplay only can offer so much. And then you come home to the hub, and it's a quiet place. And there I get to fuck around me, Abby. I get to go talk to my heroes. And then I know that I know what I'm expecting when I'm going to the hub, which is to relax. And I know what I'm expecting when I go to off on my mission. And I think I'm realizing that is kind of maybe the sweet spot of, we don't want to really give you, or depending on the genre of the game, we don't want to give you all of that, but here's what we can give you. And then finding, okay, what are things that I can do in this hub space that simulate a big budget or a big production David Cage-esque quest, if that makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like that kind of hub design, to my mind, go back to things like Mass Effect 2, you kind of that idea, exactly the same thing, that you have the mission and then you hang out with your crew on the ship. And it's a good example because you can see how in the studio, you can see how that conversation goes. They say, we have to have the action missions, obviously, but a core part of the fantasy is I'm on my boat with my dudes. I'm hanging out. I'm having a great time. We have to build that. And then the question is, what does that mean in gameplay terms? Like, can we put that on the controller rather than in a cutscene? And then that leads to the design of these hub spaces. I was also reminded of something else that you kind of suggested, both of you suggested, actually, that I think everyone has an example of that quiet moment in a AAA game that they can't forget, which kind of knocked them for six, or just took them by surprise, I guess, but kind of offered something quite different, but quite memorable. I remember for me, it was the football sequence in Uncharted 2, when you go to this Nepalese village and you play football with some little local kids. And of course, Uncharted being Uncharted, they immediately destroy the village and there's tanks and stuff. But it's a beautiful setup and it's very, very nicely done. And I remember I was working at PlayStation at the time. And when the Uncharted 2 game came out, everyone in the studio stopped to play it. And I just remember the boss of our studio going, I hate these guys because they're so confident. Because just that was the thing that really came across for us, was the sheer level of confidence you had to have in your product and your team to be able to say, this is Uncharted, it's a shooty bang bang jumping game, and we're going to take 5 minutes out to play football and it's going to work. Mm-hmm. And like, that's kind of glorious in a way to see that level of confidence. But I think one thing that's interesting to me viewing it through that lens is, in a way, indie games are often somewhat more confident in their designs, yeah, because they've got a lot less to lose, right? They're willing to try, yeah, stuff, whereas AAA games are often very worried about like getting it wrong, despite the fact, yeah, that like the other example is the chasing the goat sequence in The Witcher 3. Everyone remembers the chasing the goat sequence, and like, it's precisely because it's not the core mechanics. So it's, I guess, I'm kind of interested in sort of like, how do we expand this idea of mundanity? How do we, if we could go into AAA companies and tell them what to do, which as writers we generally can't, what do we need to be offering to make these things seem more attractive to the audience? Like, how do we expand this idea that our characters, that we can have confidence in our characters and we can have confidence in this kind of storytelling?
I'm reminded, it's funny that you bring up Mass Effect 2 and Uncharted, just because Mass Effect is what got me to want to be a game writer. And I was part of a Mass Effect role-playing community for like 10
no
years.
Way. No
way! For a long time, not for 10 years, but when I was starting out in games, I was part of a Mass Effect role-playing community, so I would like enter chat rooms as the character I created within the world, and that's how I practiced like writing and
voices. What was your character, Emma? We must pause for
okay.
you to tell us about this.
So her name is Robin Morello, and she's a biotic, an
Great.
Adept,
Great
I believe. And she had a tragic backstory, obviously, because I wrote her 10 years ago, and she was in love with a Turian, and I was role-playing with another, like, every single character that I role-played with was also another human being.
Another player?
Oh, yes.
This is great.
And
that
got me interested and comfortable in, like, using bits of myself, because Robin was like, oh, she's a specter. She can do all these things that I don't know how to do, so I'm just going to project that onto her. Sorry, but that's a tangent.
I love this.
Shout out to my Mass Effect role-playing community, who I still talk to. There's one person I still talk to, and it's lovely. For Uncharted, I think of Uncharted 4. It's my favorite because speaking to the player fantasy of, I am Nathan Drake, and I am an adventurer who does not put things in a museum, but that's my thing. Like, I'm an adventurer, and I love the thrill, and I have purpose there. And in Uncharted 4, you take that away. And the first the first mission is, you are Nathan Drake and you are a pencil pusher. What does that look like for me? How am I finding adventure in mundane life as Nathan Drake? And I remember the first opening hours of that game because, okay, I'm Nathan Drake. I am no longer, this is not my power fantasy anymore. The set piece where you go to, you're in Elena and Nate's house and you are waiting for dinner. How are you spending your time as an adventurer? You're going around and you're living out the good old days. How does that look? How does that play? And this is what gets me excited about the possibility of including mundanity in ways like this, because then you have to ask design, what does it look like to relive an adventure based on all the set pieces that we've had from previous games? How do we honor the player who's already experienced this, and it's a callback because we get to also feel the same way as Nathan? Or how do we introduce to the player that Nathan Drake he traveled the world, and maybe he's, and through, you know, shooting things and sifting through boxes, you're getting pieces back, like little vignettes of this was Nathan's life. And then you go downstairs and you have dinner with your beautiful wife, but you also play like another video game. And it's when you break down the conversations that must have been had to try and make sure that the narrative of the surrounding space, the environmental storytelling, also mirrored the emotional state that Nathan was in. I don't know how to put like how much, like, I can't understate how it like cool and important that is, because there's so many things working at once. You have your level design, your environmental design, you have the narrative of how can I get the player and Nathan to be on the same page? How can I tell the player through X, Y, or Z things that this is how Nathan is feeling, and how can we get you, the player, to feel like that? And that was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I just think it's because I've always been in the room after the conversations have happened. I'm the one that comes in and then I'm told to write a thing. I think of Civilization very quickly, just the way that the storylets were designed. The emergent narrative system is not my tool, but it was a tool made by, I believe, Kat Manning, my former boss.
Yeah, chances are, I mean, it's very much her thing, designing storylet systems.
Yes. And so a big tenant for Civ voice, or trying to get Civ voice down, was thinking about the micro, like thinking about what does a person in Han, China, what does it look like for them to write? Well, they're not writing on pen and paper. So like, trying to figure out the heart of a storylet is pretty much what did this person do every day and what did that look like? And how are they affected by the world going on around them? How is that informing this person that is not real, but I am writing them?
So really drilling down from this macroscopic view down to one individual so that you can find something to talk about.
Yes. And understanding that, like, no one exists in a vacuum. So you have to think outside of the... I guess no one exists in a vacuum. And I think human connection and seeing that video game characters are just like us just does something to us, I think. And there, I'm gonna ramble again. I think there's because of capitalism and the way that we are. Let me back up, because I love hating on capitalism, but I think there's a rise in these games where you do labor, I guess. I think of A Little to the Left, where you're like trying to fix things, or there's like power wash simulator, you know, you're fulfilling these fantasies, but it's also such a mundane everyday thing. Why are we doing them? And I think it's, I don't know. But I don't know. It's also, it's so satisfying from a writing and design standpoint to figure out like how to make a player engage with mundanity and connect to it.
I think that's got to be it, right? Because it's not, in the way you're talking, in some of the stories you're telling, it strikes me that maybe the thing that we're all circling around here isn't just the mundanity or the moment of it being from an outside perspective boring. It's not boring, right? Because it's stuck with you for all of this time, right? It's not that it's boring or that it's overly mundane. It's that it is perhaps, and tell me if you feel differently about it, but it strikes me that it's instead about revealing an aspect of the character, the story, the world that we simply don't get. And we are so thirsty for that, right? Because we have been just given all of this other high stakes stuff all of the time, these big complex decisions, wherever the plot wants to take us, that you almost need this as a contrast. And if that's the case, so if that premise is true, if it is all about the contrast, then that surely guides the point at which you place it in the course of the story, right? So I the thing that came to mind was there was a number of horror games that really have to be very intentional about tension, right, and about where they're putting tense moments, and so often you will have this like early idyllic scene that is contrasted with like a big dark moment, and it's almost always a prologue, and then like something terrible happens, and then it shifted. And in some ways, that might be a little bit heavy-handed. In fact, even Quantic Dream, right? Like the Heavy Rain starts this way, where you're having this mm-hmm. wonderful time with your child, and you're kind of used to this, and then there's like a big cut at which that changes, and that guides the rest of the plot. But it's almost like these moments that have stuck with you, they almost stuck with all of us, perhaps, because they are less expected, because they sort of are inserted where maybe we don't expect them to be. The Uncharted yep. moment is a good example, both of them, in fact, right? Because you sort of don't expect that, and yet it is still a true manifestation, evocation of that character. I don't know. What do you think? Is that right, Emma, or am I?
Yeah,
am I
that nailed it here? Completely. Thank you for being able to extrapolate that from however many minutes that I spent trying to get there. Because I realize I'm looking at the book like, wow, did I actually write this? Because when I take concepts in my head and spit them out through a keyboard, it sure sounds like I'm a different person when I'm speaking. Because I'm like, oh yeah, she's really smart. But yes, thank you. That nailed it completely, I think.
Well, I think that's one of the joys of the podcast format for us. I know people are constantly making podcasts, and it's almost kind of gauche to do that now. But like, it does mean that people can just sit and just think things through in a slightly more casual way, and kind of, you know, a more sort of 360 kind of way, and come to it from different angles. And it's always really interesting to hear that, because I think when I was reading the article about mundanity, I thought, you know, that raised lots of questions for me about, okay, the key problem here is probably verbs. Like, how do we give a player verbs they can use? And in the, you know, Uncharted example, I'm pretty sure you're like firing a water gun around yeah. your attic. But it's something yeah. that's riffing on the core Uncharted verbs, which is clever, but also kind of feels a bit awkward in some ways, perhaps. And it's a limit. I don't know how many times you can play that beat. Whereas obviously in David Cage's games, he goes wild on his interfaces.
Yeah. So interactions,
you can do any action you want. But right. the flip side of his design is you can't really get it wrong. Like, you're always just doing the next step that's been laid out for you. And he thinks about timing, I guess, and sometimes success and failure. But there isn't really any sort of choice or strategy or kind of thought process going on. And I think I would be really interested in seeing something that plays like a David Cage game, perhaps not necessarily his themes, because I never really clicked with them particularly, but like his sort of like sense of what's important in kind of the presentation of characters, but with more of a sense of the player actually having an impact moment by moment, and what does that do from a verb point of view. But listening to you talk about it, it's what's coming across to me much more is the importance of not the mundanity, but the humanity of our characters. Yeah. And that's a whole different lens in a way, because when we're doing games, we're so busy giving the player control and impact and verbs mm-hmm. and letting them win and letting them fight and letting them do all of this stuff, that the humanity almost feels like a bit of an afterthought. Because, you know, Nathan Drake's great at jumping, great at shooting, but oh, can he also just drink a coffee in a cafe? Is that a thing Nathan Drake can do? And actually, mm-hmm. bizarrely, from a design point of view, that's way harder
yeah.
like to make it work. So I think that's that challenge of kind of add a little bit of humanity is really, obviously it's compelling to us as writers because that's where we can fly, but I think it's compelling to players as well. And it's kind of, it's a whole other level of things that if we can add it to games, that we can, you know, just make it feel like a slightly more meaningful medium, maybe. Because we've all been doing it in our heads for all this time. One thing that always comes back to me is, when I was playing games as like a kid in the 90s, you'd have these box arts and manuals that would tell you the story of the game.
Yeah.
And then you'd play the game and it was just some little sprightly dude jumping up and down on platforms. And you'd be like, that is not the story that I bought. But it was what they were really saying was, we can't do this. So could you do that bit for us, please? Mm-hmm. Could you do the imagination and the character for it? So yeah, it's kind of interesting to see that. And like, one of my personal interests is adventure games and like the way that adventure games have evolved over the years. And I feel like they're still fighting this battle between, does this puzzle need to be about keys, locks and doors and combination mm-hmm. locks? Or is this puzzle about making a nice dinner for your girlfriend? Is it about, like, you know, finding the way to the restaurant when you've lost the map? These human moments that we can really understand. And I love that idea of pushing towards a design that's kind of more holistically human than the mechanical pass fail, you know, strategic, all these sort of things. I guess that makes me wonder, like, where are the limits of this idea of mundanity? Like, you mentioned the funeral in Cyberpunk. That's obviously very emotionally loaded. You mentioned making dinner in Uncharted 4. That's somewhat less emotionally loaded. Like, how much can we stretch this apart? How boring can we get? How dramatically interesting can we get, like, before it starts to fight with the gameplay system?
I think to that question, it really depends on the genre of the game. Obviously, Cyberpunk is more of the traditional RPG, instead of Uncharted. I think trying to sell it in a way of the Ofrenda offers the player a chance to shape in their head, and by extension, shape the way that V is perceived by the people of Night City and how V perceives themselves. Because, just again, you can completely skip going to the Ofrenda, and the game, I think, as far as I'm aware, lets you do that. I don't know, because again, I can't not ever do that. I don't know if the game allows the quest, the funeral specifically, to be there the entire playthrough, or if it's timed and it goes away after a certain point. I'm leaning maybe towards that, just because in my head I think, yeah, because in real life you don't get forever to say goodbye to your friend. And when you do say goodbye, and I think thinking of it from a, how does this quest serve the character of V, and like the role-playing, I guess, aspect of V, like it's serving a purpose, and that purpose is outlined by, I guess, the entire shell of the game, because there aren't, you know, funerals for every person that dies, but this is clearly because Jackie is part of is the reason why the game kicks off. So it makes sense that the studio, or that the designers want, because he couldn't stay with you throughout the entire game. This is kind of his way of, or the game's way of saying, like, you can choose to engage with this how you want, having that choice. And I think it had to be a funeral because it couldn't have been anything else. And that just comes from intuition. I think intuition is something that we don't talk a lot about as a tool, especially when it comes to designing set pieces or quests that revolve around very human everyday tasks. Because intuition is how I designed all of my memoir games in Twine. And that was also just because I made games based on what I wanted to see, which is a very indie mindset. I did it because I wanted to, and I wanted to see if it would make an impact. And it did. But that also, you are fighting with, if you're taking Twine at face value, you only have text and different types of mechanics to serve that. So you can have like cycling text to mirror cyclical thoughts, or you can have text that starts falling through the screen if you want to convey this type of emotion. Intuition and constraints, I guess. And I don't know. I would truly love to know. I want to be a fly on the wall when people at studios decide, like, yeah, we'll let you do that.
I know what you mean. I wasn't there when this decision was happening, but one of the first projects I did in the industry was a game called As Dusk Falls, which had a bunch of Quantic Dream alumni actually in it, and we had a scene in there that was very chores based. So it was very classic, right? So you're washing the dishes, you're fixing the broken AC, right? You're doing a bunch of things, and there is a sort of time limit. There's only so many things that you can do, that you can choose to do. There are a series of sort of scenes that play out, and I think that's actually, that is something I wanted to ask you about, because John, you just asked, like, well, how far can we push it before it starts to take over? The truth is, like, in so many of these, particularly the Quantic style moments, there are fail states, right? Mm-hmm. So there are minor failure states, and because they're so precise with the interaction, the failure states are typically time based QTEs, right? But there is a, you succeeded at this task or you failed at this task, and the way that we designed it, at least, was there are a series of chores you can do. Should you fail at a certain number, you will hit some threshold. And that threshold can be chopped really finely or not, but usually there's like a total failure, like a partial, and then a full success or something. And then that affects something. There's some sort of emotional payoff. In our case, it was your wife comes back and is confirmed in her worry that you are a slob, right? or actually you surprise her, right? That like actually you pull some things together. And it's hard. It's hard to support all of those things without some sort of combinatorial explosion, right? I wonder whether is embodiment good enough? Like the fact that you are the one acting through some of these actions for that scene to have the power that it does. Maybe in the football scene, that's a good example of that. Like you're going to play this little football with them. The story will move on regardless of kind of what happens. That's different, I think, from the type of scene I'm describing, John. Like where... Right. Oh, go on, please.
I love Emma's take on all this, but I was just going to say one thing that's remarkable about the football scene for me is that you can walk straight through that scene without kicking the football at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you don't have to engage with it.
You don't have to engage with it. And I'm sure there are some players who are very focused on just making progression, just do that. And a lot of the beauty of the scene is realizing that you can take a moment and then choosing to take that moment.
Right,
and
right,
I think that's a bit like what Emma was saying about the funeral
opting
sequence
in.
Yeah, exactly. It's that the act of opting in is the action that the player is taking, and then
right.
it comes from that.
I think the surprise too is for the player who thinks, "Can I kick that ball? Like, can I just chill out for a second?" And being rewarded with, "Oh, I am like we are kicking." Like that is also, I think, part of the joy of like yes and follows.
Yeah, the game permits this.
Yes,
and then does something with it. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. So is that okay? Well, then this is another question, right? So if perhaps like 15 years ago or so, our approach was you have these types of scenes, they are part of the story. You are going to play through them, but to add a little bit of optionality, player agency, we will allow you to fail or succeed with them, and there will be some interesting outcomes that will have payoffs later, right? So payoff becomes a thing that you're focused on. But maybe this style of design can be more powerful should you have a game that's big enough for it, which is you make this whole thing and it's optional. It's not on the golden path, which I'm sure is a very difficult discussion with your team. But if you can do that, then theoretically the reward is higher for the players who see it. What do you think?
I think that sounds kind of like how I view okay. Yeah, that sounds
like that's better. You like the latter if it were to be possible.
Yes. I think it's also trying the longer that I stay in dev and in narrative specifically, the more I realize that everything is just a series of compromises, constraints, and learning which hill to die on and which hill to go. I'm not dying on this one until you give me what I want. And I feel like adding mundanity is almost feels like that portion of game dev of trying to to justify a small intimate moment in a game because there are it's more than just you. You're asking you're asking an entire team of people to back you up on this. Designers, bespoke animations, all of that stuff. So then trying to quantify that outside of, because I think it would make people feel a certain way is not enough, unfortunately.
No, you're right. And yet they have had the impact, right? Like a scene like this, like the Beyond Two Souls one, has stuck with you for all of this time, right? Like there's so many examples of this. Like in Control, there's an entire level that you've been building up to that turns out to be this like crazy musical montage, right? Like same in Alan Wake too. Like Remedy does this a lot, like these flourishes where you're just like, clearly a lot of this was like a high stakes thing, but they fought to keep those things in. It's the bravery you were talking about, John, that you're like, you sort of feel like, wow, like a choice was made here and they stuck to their guns to some degree. Like maybe we're just too much in the scene. Like as devs, we see that and we're impressed by it. But hopefully players are too. Like hopefully players see that and they're like, oh, it's not just one of the regular moments we could have had. This is like a special thing that came out.
Yeah. And I think at the end of the day, we all want to feel a little special, or that's what I like about being able to, again, it's like and this is why games should be continued to be made by people, because I know that someone thought of me, maybe not me, the individual, but people like me, they thought of me, they thought of the player who is going to stray off the golden path because they want to see how far the game will let them do certain things. Like, can I wash dishes? Can I flush this toilet? Can I look in this mirror and see myself reflected back at me? Those like little touches, I guess, to feel seen.
And just adding that extra space around the functional gameplay world to give people more of that sense of that they're in a living, breathing, responsive environment.
Right.
I think that's a beautiful thing. And I think that's a thing we should be doing more of. Perhaps let's round it up there.
Yeah.
It's been a really lovely conversation. It's been a delight hearing your thought processes, Emma, and the care and attention which you give to the work that you've done and the things that you've thought about. It's always fantastic to hear how many different levels people are thinking on when they're working. And I think that's something that everybody benefits just from seeing reflected in other writers. So yeah, thank you so much for giving us your time and coming to talk to us. And
yeah,
listeners, next week we will have another writer from the Kaleidoscope to tell us what they know. So thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.